welcome to Every Artist Podcast. I'm your host, May Santiago, with my co-host, Lisa G. Today, we have a special guest, writer, actress, Tonya Young. Welcome to the show.
Welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
It's good to have you. How's your morning going?
It's pretty good. I don't know how it is where you are, but there were a lot of sonic booms and fireworks late into the night for July 4th last night. So that was a little troubling.
Totally. I can't second that. I was up pretty much most of the night. Every time I tried to fall asleep, I heard the same exact sonic booms and everything else. I was unsure. If I was like, is this fireworks or something else is going on? But,
it's funny. When I was growing up in Arkansas, like, you know, you had full access to fireworks all the time. So we would go out to the highway, listen to make sure no one was coming. And, you know, under 10, we were with a box of matches, you know, setting off fireworks. But this last night and the last few weeks just seems to terrify people and animals. Like, people are saying their animals are, like, panicking.
Right. Yeah, the new type of fireworks that they have access to now is like, something totally different. And, like,
yeah,
I've seen...
Yeah, it sounds like war. That's literally what
right.
it sounds like. And given everything else, you're like, uh-oh.
I was telling Heather about if somebody had PTSD, fireworks would probably be crazy.
Yeah, that's something that I know they do in Florida. If you are a veteran that suffers from PTSD, they give out signs that you can put in your yard. But last night, I don't think that really was effective because it was crazy last night.
Yeah, and all I could think was like, gosh, you know, people are wasting their money on these noisemakers, because I wasn't seeing some phenomenal, you know, fireworks display in the sky where it was like colors and, you know, I'm used to those big, like, fireworks displays where it's choreographed to music and it's like beautiful, but this just seemed like I'm going to go in the alley next to your house and, like, terrify you at, like, 2 a.m.
So, Tonya, tell me, how are you navigating through all this, the protesting and the COVID-19? How's 2020 been for you with all this going on?
You know, 2020 is still very unbelievable. You know, it's like the worst plot twist ever.
Right.
And keep on coming. You know, I certainly went through several weeks of not quite believing it, you know, when work stopped and we were asked to not gather with more than 6 people, and then that turned into stay home, and, you know, just being like terrified to go to the grocery store and, you know, masks and goggles and, you know, face shield thing. And, you know, I ordered a hazmat suit that took like weeks and weeks to get here from overseas, but it finally came, has a hood and like heat covering. And, you know, I go back and forth. Is this getting better? Am I being paranoid? Is it poke? To, oh my God, I need to go home, put my clothes and shoes in the washer with bleach and shower. And, you know, I think I'm like a lot of people who veer between, oh, okay, I'll just do, you know, what the steps are, to, oh no, what if it's worse than we think? You know, but, you know, the best thing about quarantine has been that I've had time for, you know, writing and painting and, you know, doing shows like yours. It really has been a gift in terms of the time, but I find the kind of like mental health part of it a little bit uneven.
Right.
Do you have state under quarantine?
to just stay under quarantine? Are they opening up?
You know, it is pretty open. You know, like, Arkansas is not one of the states that has been the most extreme. But, you know, I'm also someone who watches a lot of, like, international news and YouTube. So, you know, around Christmas, I was watching what was going on in certain provinces in China where, you know, kind of like expatriate Americans were over there and going to the grocery store in goggles, face masks, and gloves. And, you know, some of the healthcare workers were shaving their heads, like women were shaving their heads because of how much this virus was in the air, clinging on people, making healthcare workers sick. So that was kind of the narrative I had in my head of, well, I'm not sure if Donald Trump and Mike Pence and the governor know what's best, because if this is what they have, then it seems a lot more extreme than, oh, you know, you can still wear a mask if you feel like it, you know? Like, you kind of have to listen to all sources of information and do what you think is best, right? It's like ever since the HIV crisis happened, right? Like, you can have sex without a condom, but you're going to be thinking about what you may have done, and it might drive you crazy, you know, if not actually get you infected and make you sick. So better to be safe than sorry.
Exactly. And I'm in Florida, so the governor is still opening up everything. And you see what's going on in Florida now.
Yes.
Yes, a rise, which is totally what I was thinking was going to happen, but I was hoping it wouldn't, because I felt like we opened the state too soon in Florida. And I see now that to me, it feels like it was almost like
intentional.
Like Florida, Texas were like the test pilots for the whole situation to see how it was going to go. And once they saw that, then they can go back and figure out what they need to do from there. You know?
Oh, well, the governor here is not trying to shut it back down. Like,
right.
We're still opening it up. Like, wow. So smart.
Yeah. Yeah, I think financially they're looking at it from that standpoint of the businesses and the money and things like that. And the human life part of it is coming secondary now. So,
well, you know, it's interesting. Like, people have an analysis that it's really more about unemployment, like payments, mm-hmm. that they want to encourage people to go to work, because if you have the option to work, then, you know, regular unemployment plus COVID-19 enhancements don't need to be paid, right? Like, open up the economy,
right.
Get it moving. But it's at the point now where Herman Cain has COVID-19. Kimberly Guilfoyle, who is one of Trump's son's girlfriend, has COVID-19.
Mm-hmm.
And I, it's distressing to see people, including governors, still acting like, oh, it's no problem. It'll solve itself. It'll just go away in the sunshine.
Right. It's summer, and then that's the crazy part, because that's what we were told. And it's summertime in Florida and Texas and everywhere else in the United States and around the world. But yet the cases are still rising during the summer. And
astronomically.
You know, that's, yeah. So, I mean, it's kind of like they really, this virus is something that they really don't have a complete handle on understanding.
Well, I know one of the politicians himself said that, you know, what lies here to the economy, so it really doesn't matter at the end of the day to them. They're looking at
right.
the economy.
Yeah, I can see that.
Right, and I'm hopeful that there will be a vaccine, but, you know, is there an HIV vaccine? Not really.
Well,
there's
a vaccine. It's a virus, and it mutates. Just like they said that there's another version of coronavirus out there now that is spreading more fast than the first one. So it's a vaccine, just like the flu vaccine. It only covers for the certain strands that they are vaccinating for. It doesn't cover if it mutates.
That's exactly right. And the flu vaccine never stops the flu.
Right. Wow. So let's change subjects here.
Absolutely.
So, it's kind of deep there. So, Tanya, you grew up, you're part of the Creek Nation. Am I?
Yes.
Okay, so you can tell us about growing up, you know, as a Creek American, like, were you raised, like, on a reservation, or how was that, your upbringing?
No, I mean, you know, both of my parents are, you know, part Native American. My mom's family comes from the Carolinas, so that's where her, you know, sort of great-grandmother was Muscogee Creek came from. You know, a lot of Afro Native Americans don't have formal enrollment in the tribe, but, you know, self-identify and certainly culturally have, you know, kind of a relationship to, you know, growing things and treating their health as a matter of, like, eating well and growing your own food and, you know, sort of being in touch with your ancestors and your spirituality and having respect for the earth and water. And, you know, like Arkansas being one of the first states where people of African descent could own their own property. That's what drove my mom's side of the family to Arkansas to buy property. You know, a couple of the, I guess, uncles and aunts generation of my mom had been involved in, like, the military during World War II and, you know, were able to kind of have, like, consistent employment to keep that sort of family seat and that property going. And, you know, like a lot of people who are of mixed Native American and African descent, you know, it's a question of kind of knowing your culture, living that culture, being close to the land, and, you know, keeping that sense of identity within us so that it kind of inoculates us against the outside world and other influences that can tear us down as spiritual beings.
Right.
Can you tell us how you got started writing? And for comedy?
Oh, yeah, you know, my mom's dad lived with us in Eudora, Arkansas, in his, you know, sort of later years. And unfortunately, like a lot of Natives and Black people do, because of, you know, heredity and eating habits, had diabetes, so he was blind. But he would always watch Sanford and Son. And he had an extensive collection of Red Fox's comedy albums. So if you know anything about Red Fox,
yes.
Outside of television, he wasn't what you call
PC.
A child-friendly comedian.
Yeah.
He was very,
like Richard Pryor?
You know, kind of a little racy, a little sexual, a little,
yeah.
You know, and had these, like, amazing album covers that were kind of, like, in that you know, Dolomite style. Like, I remember one where Red Fox was getting, he was at the barber's, and his barber was a woman, and she didn't have a lot of clothes on, and she was shaving his face with a straight razor. So, you know, just sort of sitting at my grandfather's knee, you know, Granddaddy Jesse loved listening to that. And so as a process of spending time with him, I was listening to that, Moms Mabley, you know, Bill Cosby, all, you know, all audio recordings, because, of course, Granddaddy Jesse couldn't see at that point. And, you know, that was definitely an immersion into, I think, which is what is a particularly strong African-American coping strategy, right? Like, sense of humor, what's funny, what's raw, what's real, you know, even what's dirty about human life, and, like, you know, saying those things that everyone can sort of get and relate to. And, you know, that was definitely something that kind of baked into my brain. And when I, you know, went through high school and college, definitely was watching a lot of like different movies and shows. You know, was writing my own screenplays when I was in college and sending them, you know, having like stage readings and all that. It's funny because when I wrote my first screenplay in college, I sent it to the Black Filmmaker Foundation, right, which is run by Warrington Hudlin. And, you know, it wasn't like, oh, we love it, we're going to buy it, we're going to make it. He wrote me like a one-page letter, Warrington did, saying, this is very interesting, and if you make it, we will consider acquiring it. Now, all these letters and words meant nothing to me. I was like, oh. So, you know, I went on and, like, did other work and had other careers, but in, like, politics and different things. But, you know, the writing bug was there. The sort of humor bug was there. You know, and I was fortunate enough living in New York to have worked with different directors, like Brett Ratner when he was doing music videos, and then eventually I got like a entry-level job on the Chris Rock show, you know, met Nelson George there, was able to be on set there, and by hook and by crook, I ended up working at Nickelodeon on a show that Bill Cosby did after his son unfortunately passed away. So my first script
was that the animated show?
Yeah, it was the animated show. It was
Little
yeah.
Bill,
the first or one of the first animated shows for African Americans called Little Bill. Yeah, and
I loved it.
It wasn't it a beautiful show?
Yes, it was. Thank
it
you.
Just you know we had such an incredible cast, an incredible team, and you know, the art was based on the collage art of Barnett Honeywood. She had done the books with Dr. Cosby, as well as Dr. Alvin Poussant, who was a child psychologist from Harvard. And, you know, Dr. Cosby had come and met with the heads of production and programming at Nickelodeon, and his agent. I forget his agent's name, but his agent was like the son of Marilyn Monroe's agent. So, you know, I was so young and so starstruck, but I was in that meeting taking notes, and it was honestly one of the most phenomenal things I've ever seen. To see him talk, to see his agent talk, his agent had his foot in a boot, not a cast, and he was like drinking some kind of like protein shake. You know, this was like my introduction to a lot of Hollywood culture, like what it is to be a creative person and be represented by a powerful agent, to see how execs are in the room when they want to buy your persona, your fame, your presence. And, you know, it was really a gift to me to work on that production. I ended up getting a Peabody Award for my script.
I was just going to ask you about that. I was just like, man, you already won a Peabody Award in 2001 and a National Literacy Award. That's really amazing. Is amazing.
Thank you. I mean, it was, I think, a surprise to me, and I give all the credit in the world to Nickelodeon and to Dr. Bill Cosby and, you know, Dr. Alvin Poussant, all the amazing experts that worked on the show. But, you know, let me just take a moment to talk about the incredible cast. I mean, we had Madeline Kahn, Gregory Hines, Felicia Rashad, the excellent young voice actors, you know, phenomenal people who are our producers and, you know, kind of creative director and, you know, people who've gone on and done like other tremendous work. And, you know, I think that the best situation, being a creative person, being a writer or an actor, is to find yourself in a business situation where there's plenty of money, there's plenty of support, there's plenty of access to having your work seen, you know, because of course the episodes broadcast on Nickelodeon as well as CBS, because it was a kind of like family show. And, you know, to have people of stature as your partners, even when you're not kind of like, you know, at the top of your craft yet, it's a way that you're kind of like trusted and brought along and, you know, really being an apprentice in a situation where you're among giants.
So coming into the business and landing this amazing start in your career, and you're working with the heavy hitters in the industry of Hollywood, like the Bill Cosbys and Chris Rock, Felicia Rashad, oh my God. And like years later, are you affected by the allegations and things that, you know, surround Bill Cosby? Has that affected your career in any way, being associated with him in the beginning of your career? Or, you know,
there's multiple ways I want to answer that question. I mean, what I will say about my experience working with Dr. Cosby on that show is that, you know, for me, it was an excellent, incredible experience. It was a very diverse crew, you know, men, women, LGBT, a lot of different communities were represented. And, you know, the only interaction that I ever had with him was like, you know, very supportive. You know, when I wrote the script and it got awards, you know, what he said to me was like, nice job, kid. And, you know, he was such a like phenomenon and busy person, mm-hmm. and also working on another, you know, other projects outside of the animated show. There wasn't any of that stuff. Let's put it like that.
Right.
You know, I think that anyone who has interacted with people who stand accused of things, whether it's, you know, Donald Trump or, you know, Catholic priests or, you know, it's, they don't show that. Or like, you know, I think California just had the Golden State Killer, this guy who was a cop admitted it was him. It's like the person who does the bad thing doesn't do the bad thing to everyone, right?
Right.
So I'm not in a position to say, like, well, I had a great experience with Dr. Cosby. He was utterly supportive, professional, and, you know, a great educator, a great person to learn from. That was my experience, and that experience doesn't eclipse other people's experiences, right, their alleged experiences. I have a lot to say. I've met some of the accusers, you know, on, you know, just being on set on different projects, and you know, I'm happy to talk about that. But I hope that answered your question. I mean, I don't feel like
totally,
I've had you know, some stain on my work and my
right.
career because of my association with Dr. Cosby. I mean, he. The body of work cannot be denied.
Exactly.
His kind of groundbreaking work as an African American man, and, you know, someone who he and his wife Camille Cosby have supported education and HBCUs, and, you know, there was a certain point in politics where the fact that Dr. Cosby so powerfully, you know, effectively and very funnily, you know, portrayed this kind of like wholesome America's dad persona with black skin, it definitely had, I believe, an impact on the election of like David Dinkins in New York, the election of Barack Obama. There was a different way of seeing, you know, sort of black men and black male fatherhood, and it had its impact for the good.
I think the show itself kind of basically gave a new perspective on the black family. I mean, because the last time we had a TV show that portrayed a black family was Good Times, and they lived in the ghetto, and that became the kind of idea that people had.
Problem.
Yeah, that we just struggle and we're barely making it. And then when the Cosbys came along and that show just kind of gave us another perspective, there are educated black people that are living phenomenal lives. And the people like me growing up, seeing that, that kind of inspired me to want that type of life for myself, to look at that perspective instead of just looking at the other perspective that was given to us from somebody else's ideals. It just, to me, and then the whole idea of having a father and a mother in the house, that was something that was very important as well. And I think it affected a lot of people in a major way, positively, like just seeing those type of images, black love and, you know, a strong black family just kind of being represented to the masses and being accepted by the masses.
Right. And, you know, also the fact that they had intact culture, you know, all of the great like music mm-hmm. and art and fashion and hair and, you know, mm-hmm. all these things done in a way that was aspirational, that was attainable, that was fashionable. So many things where, you know, even now the national dialogue about like Black Lives Matter and black men versus the cops, there's an attempt by one side to portray black men in a certain way, which is not a comprehensive way, right? And there has to be a counterpoint to that that just says, no, there's more to people who happen to be of African descent than that. And, you know, that's kind of, there's a lot of pushback, there's a lot of push forward. Another good thing about quarantine is that it's certainly given me an opportunity to be involved in activism. You know, but I think that Dr. Cosby's work has cast a long shadow in a good way, that it created an opportunity for, you know, Damon Wayans to star in My Wife and Kids. It created an opportunity for, you know, there to be a very enthusiastic reception from advertisers for, you know, the work of Kenya Barris on, you know, ABC, as well as on Netflix, the work of Shonda Rhimes, because, you know, I'm not saying that Dr. Cosby was the only one, but I feel like he was one of the first phenomenally financially successful television investments that happened, and that kind of proved, you know, because for a long time people would say like, oh, black films don't make money, black TV shows, there's no overseas international sales, and that wasn't the case. You know, he put in the work on the road for years being a comedian and, you know, Red Fox, but in a different way, in a cleaner way. He was, you know, he touched a lot of people and kind of was beloved for his talent and storytelling before there was social media and before there was television everywhere. And you know, I think I'm certainly one of the people who has learned from his example and, you know, also his misstep. You know, we're at a different moment as far as the, you know, treatment of subordinates. I'm not even going to say men and women because it's not just that. If you pay attention, there's, you know, men being, let's say, groomed and exploited on set. And, you know, it's not just one person who's done it, and you know, just to get back to your question, like, how has it affected my writing career? Well, you know, I've had like phenomenal opportunities to work for, you know, other, or work with other black creators, you know, whether it's, you know, Russell Simmons and Stan Lathan when they had their overall deal with HBO. You know, I got to travel to, you know, Philadelphia in particular and work with young poets there to do a kind of like slam poetry competition on HBO. And, you know, really it's funny, but also sad, you know, there was still the same kind of conflict, you know, certain producers that we worked with really, really wanted to focus on what I'll call pathological black stories. Whereas, you know, Philly gave us, you know, children of veterans who were, you know, Ivy League students who were, you know, talking about their perception of the struggle of their fathers, you know, black whiteness and black fatherhood and being in the military and all of that, you know, versus, you know, producers I worked with who were like, no, you know, this, you know, person who, you know, her mom, you know, has like several children and, you know, they live in like Section 8 housing and, you know, there's just, I'm not saying that all the stories aren't valid, but, you know, when you have to pick and choose, it was distressing to me that, you know, a black producer would really want to be in that place where it's like, no, no, let's find some like terrible struggle story
right.
that, you know, is melodramatic and not aspirational, and let's
right.
cut the story about, you know, the black family that has a mom and a dad and the father's a veteran and, you know, that son actually went on to be, you know, to study at Oxford and, you know, I think he's on the pipeline to being a professor and he's married and has a pregnant wife right now. And I'm not saying that you can't have both, but in a world of choices, let's just say I was more excited about the Philly team and, you know, some of these really interesting young writers and poets who, you know, were children of military people. Like, you know, there was another girl who was very Christian, both parents in the military, and, you know, she was learning Arabic because her idea was that she was going to go into the military and help deal with, you know, kind of like issues in the Middle East. And that wasn't, oh, I live in Section 8 housing and I have to go down to the welfare, like, precious. Do you know what I'm
yeah.
saying? Like,
I have a question. Being a writer of, you know, Creek, Creek ancestry and African ancestry.
Yeah.
Do you feel that there is not enough stories told in the life of modern indigenous people? Because it doesn't seem like there's a lot of representation for people of indigenous background on, you know, in front of us, like modern stories.
You know, I definitely agree with that. I think that there have been, you know, sort of little spurts here and there. I think a lot of the phenomenal, you know, movie work involving Native American stories has been similar to black people. It was that kind of like white savior, whether, you know, it's stories that focus on the white lead, Dances with Wolves, The Revenant. You know, my friends who are Native American actors who've been in those projects or, you know, the sort of Ghost Nation and Westworld, or, you know, there are newer shows like Goliath on Amazon and Stumptown on broadcast television where there are roles for modern Native Americans, but they are perhaps not the, you know, sort of like number one or two on the call sheet roles. So there's representation, but again, often through the pivot of the white lead. You know, I've been involved with the Native American casting group, and, you know, also being a fan of the work of L.A. Skins and, you know, even like the Santa Fe Film Festival, there's pockets and places where Native American storytellers are being embraced and supported, where you can see their work. And, you know, there's the sort of play and musical work that happens at the Autry out in Los Angeles. You know, none of these entities and processes are, you know, everything. It hasn't translated into there being like a primetime hit show about Native Americans on broadcast television. And I think Netflix had a show with a, you know, first time female Native lead and it got canceled after one season. But, you know, that part of American life has yet to be, you know, told fully. You know, I think there is a divide between presenting Native Americans as historical, rural, living on a reservation, not modern, And I'm not saying that in a bad way. Like, all of that is great. But, you know, there are Native Americans, you know, living in the city, pursuing acting careers, living in, you know, rural areas and writing novels, writing screenplays, writing shorts. And, you know, I think that there is an opportunity to get your work read and produced, you know, not in huge numbers, but, you know, like Robert Redford's Sundance Institute. There are, you know, opportunities to, like, have your one-act play read. Used to be in theaters, but now everyone's doing it through Zoom. You know, there's a breakthrough reading series that happens in Atlanta, Georgia, as well as in Los Angeles. And there's a brother that runs that organization. And what's great about it is that if you get your work read, you are automatically submitted to the blacklist, which is a place where, you know, your teleplay, your screenplay can be read by, you know, sort of heavy hitters in the industry. So, you know, being a Native American person, I, you know, certainly have written stories that are very close to my heart. I wrote a play called Wampum, which is about, you know, sort of a woman who has, you know, had to make some choices to survive and, you know, gotten involved in like street life and sex work. But when people in her family die, she has to kind of go back to the land that had been in the family. And, you know, I think we're all familiar with the shenanigans that go on when there's heir property and taxes that aren't paid. Your family land can end up going up for auction.
Yep,
so, you know, the kind of initiating incident of the story is, you know, she goes back, you know, with her, you know, boyfriend who's struggling with addiction, and goes to the tax assessor's office with a whole bunch of other interested parties who want to get their hands on this land. And, you know, because she has cash in hand from what she's been doing, she's able to recover the family land. And then there's a whole bunch of situations that have to do with like class and, you know, being Native American as opposed to Black, as opposed to white in the South, which is a lot of, it's a lot. You know, I mean, I think we're all hearing these stories about like missing and murdered Indigenous women. You know, I think that people of color have to deal with that gaze that thinks of you in a way that doesn't value you, right?
Right.
And if you're a woman and you're of color and you're alone or engaging in sex work, you can be not only taken advantage of, but, you know, you can end up missing or murdered. And that's
right.
Certainly something that is real and has, you know, sort of made its way in a very specific set of like scenes and characters in that particular work that again is called Wampum. You know, and, you know, not to be just sort of like in this drama place, like, you know, I've been very lucky in the last year to have done principal work in a couple of short projects. And one writer and director, Lonnie Henderson, who's African-American from Virginia, he wrote a kind of like Black superhero character who has his own kind of like Justice League. And my character, Miss Fire, is a superhero of Native descent who is a kind of like Indigenous chef in her kind of like Clark Kent life. But then once she transforms and has her powers, you know, this sort of like Justice League that exists in the world of the story, the project is called Superstar and it's in a few festivals right now. You know, they're looking at situations around the world, whether it's Black Lives Matter and police violence or, you know, lack of access to clean water. And this set of superheroes really kind of like, in a campy, fun kind of action and kind of sci-fi way, they kind of band together to try to like solve these problems.
Is that something that's available for viewing or is it just going through the festival circuit now? Oh.
I think it's in the festival circuit now. And, you know, what's fantastic is that because of social media, you know, Lonnie's been posting pictures and clips, and those pictures and clips on Instagram got liked by Lee Daniels. And I think Lee Daniels was looking for creative projects in the last year. So, you know, anyone who is creative, whether you're acting, writing, collaborating with other people, you know, sort of shooting your stuff or directing, but anyone who can kind of create something and get it up on social media, and this didn't exist really before, you can have an immediate way to share your concept or get seen by people who, you know, are thought leaders, who are successful producers, who've, you know, been through the struggle, but, you know, who also might see the promise of your talent and your vision. And I was thrilled for Lonnie when that happened, and I was very excited. Just, you know, again, to have my part and my, you know, costuming and performance kind of get seen by people in general, but, you know, certainly people of that stature who've done phenomenal work. It can't do anything but inspire you to do more and want to, you know, go deeper in your business opportunities and business relationships.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. I hope something comes of that project. Sounds very interesting.
me too, but I think it's timely too, because again, it's not Thanos, it's police brutality. It's not, you know, a different planet. It's our planet, you know?
Right.
And I just love the fact that, you know, I think a lot of people who do like webisodes might not go as far with the script, with the concept, with having enough story there potentially to go to series or to make a movie. You know, a lot of people, you know, when they're on hiatus from acting or whatever, will make, you know, a webisode with, you know, no costumes, no location, no effects, no whatever. But when you see someone invest all those layers in a project like he did, the hair and makeup, the everything was so delicious and well done. And, you know, he had made a couple of other web projects, you know, much like a younger Issa Rae. And it showed. It showed he just was so good, and he acted in it and directed it and, you know, everything, including the craft service and, you know, having costuming. It was such a first-class experience that, as an actor, you know, gives you the inspiration, where it's a lot of work to remember and, you know, study all your lines. But when you get treated in such a professional way that really helps you showcase your talent and your work, it makes you want to do more. It makes you want to collaborate. It makes you want to make sure that that project has a life beyond, you know, I think it was featured in the Los Angeles International Film Festival, the indie shorts part of the festival, and I think there are other places coming up where, you know, it can be seen, and a lot of the festivals are going online, so it might be possible to see Superstar, the movie, you know,
great.
in the next 6 months, and I'll definitely find out for you.
That's awesome. And before we go, could you tell us, like, what's in the works for you, like in the near future, any projects that you're currently working on?
Absolutely. One thing, because of coronavirus, you know, I was sort of trapped in the house and thinking about, you know, it's a struggle not to be infected and not to be taken out by this virus for, you know, people who are housed and who have access to food and healthcare. But, you know, what about the homeless? I wrote a short film about, you know, everyone's terrified about other people breathing on them or being too close to them. But, you know, what happens when someone who is homeless is having a medical emergency, and there's a small constellation of characters, you know, sort of like a Native American artist who, you know, is sort of isolated in her apartment and making those terrifying runs that we all have to make to the grocery store, where she encounters this homeless person in crisis, And then there's, you know, an indigenous woman who's working as a domestic worker, right? One of those essential workers who must go to work. It's a short that I think very quickly touches on the plight of a lot of the lesser seen people who are dealing with this crisis. So, you know, I'm hoping to fundraise and get that script, which is just like a, you know, 5 or 10 page script produced in the next couple of months. And it's called Paper Crown. I've been working on a horror script for several years. You know, I think one of the issues with healthcare in this country is there's, you know, racism and discrimination right. against who gets good healthcare, especially for Black women, especially for Native American women and men. So there's this sort of racist doctor who, you know, in the world of the story, came from South Africa where he was trying to benefit from apartheid and white supremacy. And, you know, fortune led him to a big city and doing sports medicine. And we know what the population of professional athletes look like. And if you unleash a racist doctor in that, you know, professional athlete world where people have extreme, you know, success and extreme careers and their injuries. And anyway, this racist doctor runs amok. And I think it's a perfect formula for horror and very much like what's going on in the real world. And that project is called Cypher. So I'm shopping that around. And then, you know, the last thing is I've been very lucky to work on a project for one of the cable channels called Real Husbands of Hollywood with Kevin Hart and J.B. Smoove and Robin Thicke and all these incredible comedians. So I have written a sitcom script, which is kind of like Designing Women and a little bit of Scandal. And mm-hmm. that script is called Underemployed. And I am, you know, currently shopping that sitcom script around. It's kind of multi-camera, which is quite different than some of the single cam comedy work that I've written for and been involved with in the last several years. But I'm really excited about all of those projects. And you know, there's shorts that I've worked at that can be seen on the festival circuit and maybe online. And you know, again, that one called Superstar. There's another I did with a great writer and improv comedian, Ashley Shine. It's called PMI, and it probably will be in Outfest and several other festivals and viewable online. You know, I think that especially now, especially with the consciousness around what's called BIPOC, Black, mm-hmm. Indigenous People of Color, being a presence on screen, being a presence as writers and producers and, you know, sort of in the crews, that perhaps more than before, there is at least an interest. You know, my work is definitely being read by people who are, you know, looking at George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and, you know, this phenomenon of racist violence and wanting to, you know, populate screens differently. And, you know, I would encourage any actors, writers, producers, creators, you know, you don't need permission to go and create your work. You don't need permission to submit it to festivals, to put it on YouTube, to put it on Twitch. You don't need permission. You have a vision. You have something to say. You know, use this time of quarantine and, you know, COVID-19 to take care of your mental health, take care of your loved ones, but also take care of, you know, creating your body of work and executing it.
That's well, I have a quick question for you. Well, two things. How was it really working for Kevin Hart? Is he a full off-screen too?
he is amazing. I don't know anyone who has as much energy as he does. Like, he does projects back to back to back to back. And he is warm and, you know, such a loyal person, has such a, like, amazing, like, group of, you know, friends who kind of came up with him through the comedy scene, you know, friends and family that he absolutely looks out for and takes care of. But, you know, because of that job, you know, three funny things. I once had to wake him up, you know, in a hotel room where we were shooting the show. And I felt so bad because I could see, you know, he is a dynamo. And, you know, you could just see that when you're in deep sleep, you're startled. But, you know, as kindly as I could, I did that. And that's, like, one of my most, like, visceral memories. Like, oh, I'm sorry. We need you to wake up. Number two, you know, because it was a show that, much like Curb Your Enthusiasm, was there was a script kind of as an outline, but there was also a lot of room to improv on set. And
see, I didn't even know that show was scripted.
Well, there was a script, but it was definitely
It was hard. Like, when it first started, I thought it was real. I thought it was a reality show at first when it first started.
The fakest realest show on TV. But, you know, because sometimes, you know, you do take after take at different angles because it's single camera, right? And so different actors would mess up their lines. So, you know, Kevin Hart is such a professional. He was like, I guarantee it. I'm going to get this line on this take, or, you know, I bet you $100. So he bet the producers that he would get this, you know, line right on the next take. And he didn't. And so he lost $100, but because, you know, it's Hollywood and it's Black Hollywood, you know, they didn't want to, like, take his $100. So because I'm on set, they gave it to me. And I was like,
aww,
one of my victories for being, you know, in these, like, cramped, hot, like, houses, because we would shoot on location in these beautiful houses around town. But I was, like, you know, not expecting that. So that was kind of like a tip because, again, Black Hollywood, everyone has money. Like, it's kind of like winning the bet was the point, not the money. So, no, you take the money. I was like, oh, okay, I'll do that. you know, just being around, again, phenomenal people who've done phenomenal work, whether it's Mike Epps guesting on the show, Wayne Brady. You know, you get to see and interact with, like, you know, Faison Love, like, amazing human, talented, real, accessible. You know, everyone goes to the crafty table, everyone goes to the catering tent, and you know, meeting, like, incredible people who, you know, work their whole careers with, like, Jamie Foxx, like, you know, Johnny Mack, and just amazing, talented writers who've also done radio, who continue to, you know, write and produce for film, for Netflix, you know, and having that dialogue. Like, even if you're present in a entry-level role, it can lead to an opportunity to write. It can lead to an opportunity to know someone, to put you on game. Like, you know what? Netflix wants to hear pitches from people of color. You know, LA Skins had an event at Netflix where we got to meet different, like, you know, production and development folks who specifically wanted to hear from, you know, Native American creators. You know, even if you're living kind of in a rural area off grid, if you've got Facebook, if you've got, you know, Instagram, there are opportunities, there are, you know, ways that you can kind of keep on top of what's new, what's in development, what's being shot, who's in it, who's looking for, you know, writers, who's looking to read scripts, who's doing stuff. You know, again, like, you look for pockets of money, you look at schedules that need to be filled, you look at, you know, companies and producers and people who have a brand, who are looking for projects that enhance that brand. So, you know, even more than ever before, being a person of color, being of Native American descent, being Black, being anything that you are, having immigrant experience, having experience, you know, having been homeless, all of those things give you something to write about and give you, you know, authority and something that people are really looking for inside writers' rooms. You know, the last project that I'll mention is one that, you know, I was fortunate to work with Sterling Nix Bradley and his son, Ben Nix Bradley, on. We were able to hire two incredible Black comedians, Greg Edwards and Candy Ford, to do a project called Upstart, which is on Twitch. We did like a 4-hour live stream of all the episodes. And, you know, again, on the to get to your point about working with Kevin Hart, you see someone who is just purely talented and a great storyteller. You kind of flex those muscles at work every day, but then it empowers you to be able to turn around, go to the comedy club, find other talented, you know, strong African-American voices, and then create a project that kind of builds on who they are as people, their strengths as storytellers and comedians, and then takes that to the marketplace. And, you know, if there's anything that I can encourage your listeners to do, especially in this, you know, situation right now where a lot of us have time on our hands, like, film that 1-minute joke, film that, you know, 5-minute script, put it on Twitch, put it on some platform where you have absolute ownership and control, and, you know, see what comes of it. Because when, you know, Hollywood or New York or casting people call, you know, even TikTok, they're going to be looking, and they need people who are talented and funny, and the door is not shut.
Right. Mason, do we have some more time? Because
yeah,
I just wanted
to...
Huh?
Yeah, go ahead.
I just wanted to know, just because of something that you touched on a little earlier about how the scripts are being written and how it's kind of like, I want to say stereotyped for the role. I have noticed, like, there are no scripts with Indian or indigenous people in it that are not completely stereotyped, such as, you know, my family, the older people in my family grew up watching Bonanza and things of that nature. Was that offensive for you? And how have you, in your career, kind of worked it in or are working it in so that, you know, there's more of a spotlight and a normal or natural spotlight for people and not just indigenous, but even Black people or, you know, because a lot of the scripts are stereotypical. Do you think that has changed over the years? That's a lot of
questions. I mean, I think it's two separate conversations, right? We've got the drama and we've got the comedies. And, you know, even... You know, as a person of African descent, like, there is a lot of, like, easy ways to get a laugh in comedy if you're a Black person, right? I'm not gonna pare that down. You know, I love a dirty joke. I love a playing dumb kind of joke. I love a, you know, a lot of it is kind of like, you think about sitcoms, a lot of it is like, someone doesn't have all the information and, like, you know, mishaps and comedy situations ensue. All of it is valid, but I think that we're in a moment where, you know, you think about the blackface, you think about the cooning and how destructive it can be, you know, whether it's Terry Crews wanting to kind of like excuse some of the more problematic parts of like police violence and, you know, kind of like poo-poo Black Lives Matter, whether it's, you know, kind of, there are a lot of YouTubers who are in trouble for getting the easy laugh by blackface, whether it's Shane Dawson or, you know, David Dobrik, like some of their collaborators, Seth Francois, are talking about that being problematic because it gets the laugh, it gets the numbers, people make money, but it's distressing because it needs a lot of people, especially young people, to think that's all there is to being a Black person. Similarly, a lot of the ways that Native Americans have been portrayed in comedy and drama, this kind of like historical, you know, character who's like either violent or passive, it's not the full flower of the living, breathing human beings who are surviving and fighting for, you know, their, you know, treaty rights, their human rights, their tribal rights, clean water, you know, there are amazing people who are doing incredible things with business, whether it's casinos or, you know, actually there's a Muscogee Creek writer who, you know, staffed on a couple of shows in Hollywood. So, you know, there's a lot of bad to point to, but there's also a lot of good that's coming down the pipeline. I think that Westworld and Goliath have done a lot of amazing, you know, sort of representation of modern Native Americans doing great things, and being, you know, relatable characters, not just a two-dimensional stereotype, you know, or being a prop in the script. I think that, you know, Stumptown has had a representation of Native elders. Again, that Netflix show that had an Indigenous lead. There's, you know, sort of, there's writing work that's happening. There's film work that's under more under the control of Indigenous people. I think Jason Momoa shot his own kind of like Native American movie in the last year. There are things coming down the pipeline that enhance, right? There was a time when there was only one Black woman character, you know, Diane Carroll on, you know, television, one Black family, whether that was Good Times or, you know what I mean? Like we're going from a time where there's one, say again?
There was a status quo. It was like, you know, you had to have that raisin in the sun.
Well, yeah, but now we have more raisins. And, you know, like, again, like you look at the body of work from Shonda Rhimes and from Kenya Barris, where it's taken them years in their career to get to that point where they can be just that kind of true to themselves as storytellers. I would like to say that there are Native American writers, actors who are on a parallel track and a parallel trajectory of success. And I can't necessarily point to that outside of the indie realm. Like, there is a track and there's an opportunity for Native American writer, director, creators through the festival circuit that hasn't necessarily become a hit show in primetime, that hasn't necessarily become a blockbuster film based on their novel, their script, their life. In the indie realm, yes, but, you know, and I don't know what that is. I don't know what the alchemy of, you know, development people being excited to support a project like that. The festival circuit, you know, once you get out of, like, the indie festivals into Tribeca, into Toronto, into Sundance, it needs to. I think that the development of Native American storytellers and projects needs to grow and, you know, kind of, I'm not saying that money is the only report card, but I think that, again, the kind of blaxploitation pictures of the 70s, you know, that drove even the James Bond series to have, like, Black villains and Black leads. The, you know, phenomenal success of, you know, Norman Lear's Good Times and of the Cosby Show. Those kind of dollars and cents phenomenons, I think, grease the wheels for future projects, future creators, other comedians who are playing dads on television, other writers who want to create story worlds and tell about their life, you know, and I, you know, hope to be one of those people who can take projects about the Native American family, the Native American experience, you know, the kind of Afro-Indigenous experience, and make those characters come to life and make those stories come to life. But, you know, again, when we're talking about, like, Hollywood, streaming, the international market, you kind of need to find those opportunities not only to be heard and to be produced, but to be successful and win awards. You look at a Lee Daniels, you look at a Kenya Barris, you look at a Spike Lee, and, you know, Smoke Signals was an amazing project for its you know, reach and the way that it was produced. And I think that there has to be work that gets taken to that level. And I think it's all of our responsibility to create it, support it, go out and watch it, you know, whether it's in a movie theater, if we ever go to movie theaters again, or on streaming. But, you know, you can kind of see the footsteps of what success looks like, and there's no reason that Native Americans can't do that, much like the kind of successful African-American storytelling entrepreneurs, the successful Asian storytelling entrepreneurs, both in America and abroad. There is work being done right now by, like, phenomenal organizations like LA Skins, and different Native American, like, casting and writing support systems like Sundance, to get the work to that level of success and appreciation.
All right.
Well, there you have it. We want to thank our special guest, award-winning writer, actress, Tony Young, for joining us today. We had a great conversation with her today. Great time. We'd love to have you back on the show in the future when time permits.
You know, Lisa and Maze, I so appreciate being heard. I, you know, I can't wait to, you know, listen to the playback. But, you know, also I want to thank everyone who has ever, you know, given me an opportunity to do this kind of work and even think it was possible. You know, I think I've been really fortunate to have been inspired and employed and that, you know, not even to get to the awards, but that really makes you feel validated, even if you have to keep a different day job, you know, and I want to encourage everyone of, you know, all backgrounds and, you know, sort of levels to use your time to, you know, tell stories that mean something to you, you know, with your pen, with your computer, with your, you know, mouth and your body, like, tell those stories and you'll find supportive people like Lisa and Maze who will hear you and help amplify your work and your opportunities.
Wow.
Excellent. Yeah, it was definitely an honor to have you here. And, you know, like I said, we'd love to have you on in the future when things, you know, kind of let up or whatever. Or you could come and hang with us at any time, just to, you know. So I want to thank my co-host, Lisa G. And everyone have a great Sunday. It was amazing having Tanya on here. We love the conversation. We love the knowledge that you just broke down a lot of different aspects of the industry and writing and different things like that. So we really appreciate that. So everyone have a great day.
Awesome. My pleasure. All right. Be well.
Bye.